Listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 12th, 2025. Well, exciting times for Canadians. After riding the wake of empires for better than four centuries, we find ourselves at childhood's end, finally able to chart an independent course. And it's all thanks to Donald Trump. Yes, there's much to begrudge about him, but credit where it's due. If not for the bellicose blatherskiting of Mammoth Mouth South, we'd never leave the warmth of the metaphorical house. But what's to become of us if we do? Eve Engler is a Canadian journalist, author, and activist. He's written 13 books on and about the perfidy of Canada and its foreign policy. The latest, co-authored with Owen Schock, is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Recent among his many articles at eveengler.com examining the antithetical of all writ above is Feed the War Machine to Appease Trump is Ruling Class Solution. Eve Engler in the first half. And Victoria City Council has hatched another world-class scheme to divest you via tax rises of your nest egg and those of the next seven generations. Yes, another desperately needed mega project replete with vague cost estimates, dubious social uptake, and a returning cast of characters best known from past fiscal planning fiascos. This time it's the aged Crystal Pool, a stone's throw from the erstwhile Memorial Arena, and in sight on tippy toes of the one-of-a-kind Johnson Street Bridge. Ross Crockford is an award-winning journalist, editor, author, civic activist, and co-founder of the watchdog website johnsonstreetbridge.org. He's, too, recipient of a Western Magazine Award for Business Writing, the Jack Webster Award of Distinction for Investigative Reporting, and he's a National Magazine Awardee for sports writing. Ross is also a regular contributor to Victoria's Focus magazine, where his latest article, How Much Would It Cost to Fix the Crystal Pool, rings a familiar tone. Ross Crockford and A Pool Too Far in the second half. But first, Eve Engler and the Quisling option, Canada running out of running room. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Of course, now, Eve, my inbox is filling with hair-pulling and cloth-rending articles, all exhorting I take Donald Trump's threat to annex Canada seriously. Well, Eve, I can't do that. I'm unable to. So for the rest of the country, how should they take the Clown King's threat?
Well, I think he is somewhat serious. I mean, I think this, he clearly wants to put on return open imperial annexationist kind of thinking in U.S. Foreign policy. I mean, obviously, the U.S. has been incredibly imperial. There's degrees to which that's been sort of the openly stated goal. And Trump is pretty clear that he wants to, you know, he's openly stating from Greenland to Panama to Gaza to Canada. So, but, you know, simultaneously, it's obviously also a negotiating position. And he has shown the ability to get the vast majority of the Canadian political world to follow what he wants. And, you know, I have every single Liberal Party leadership candidate announcing that we're going to hit the 2% of GDP military spending target in 2 years, which is probably impossible to do. Mark Carney pushed it back a couple more years. Chrystia Freeland and Carina Gould, I believe, both said 2027. So you're getting these money put into the border. We're going to, you know, defend our borders and militarize our borders and securitize our borders. So he's getting a lot of what he wants immediately. It's just sort of being conceded. So I guess from Trump's perspective, this is just the U.S. using its power. He likes to claim these wins, whether they are as big a wins as he claims is not. He likes to present that. And it feeds this notion of, American nationalism, America, make America great again. That's, you know, we are the biggest and toughest, and the world's going to bow down to us. So, but I think what I do think ultimately, maybe we should go in a different question, but I think we should take it seriously. I think progressives, anti-imperialist Canadians should take it seriously in the sense that we have been offered, I think, a bit of an opportunity to try to take some of this anti-US, anti-Trump sentiment and push it in a direction of, yeah, Canada shouldn't just follow the ugly American in it, all its imperial activities around the world. And quite honestly, over the past 20 years, certainly since Harper, since maybe the 2003 Iraq and the 2005 or 6 ballistic missile defense, both Harper and Trudeau's governments have been decidedly pro-Washington. And with almost nothing that's, you know, every Canadian government since World War II has been pro-Washington, but almost nothing that goes against the U.S. empire. So I think there's a little bit of an opportunity to push, to use the sort of vulgarness of saying the quiet part out loud, if you like, part of Trump, to push for a slightly better Canadian foreign policy, or at least breaking away from the U.S. empire, or maybe better put, even forcing the left, the social democratic left, to grapple with that, which the reality is the social democratic left, the NDP particularly, has been so much, so supportive of U.S. Imperial foreign policy in recent years.
This deal-making strategy of Trump's is pretty worn by this point. I wonder if anybody in the States is quantifying, when you talk about his wins, and his easy wins in this case, if they're quantifying what they're losing in the nature of Canadian esteem for their colleague or cousins south and so forth and so on. But in Canada, the reaction, as you mentioned, is, has there been any reaction other than the crudely put boot licking of the American position, as you've just elucidated? Is there anybody else talking about this as an opportunity for us to diversify our trade partners, to make firmer stances in the Arctic, to maybe stretch our hands across the pole to Russia and across the Pacific to China?
Certainly nothing with regards to Russia that I've seen. There's been more anti-China than there has been. There's been a little bit of echoing in business circles in the Globe and Mail, for instance, about, well, China is the obvious trade possibility. If the U.S. is going to slap on huge tariffs, China's the obvious trade possibility. That's been mentioned a few places. It's been more, far more sort of, okay, Washington, why are you going after us? We're a great alliance against China, and we want to work with you against China. That way more of that rhetoric. So, you know, there's somewhere in some place I saw a story about Canada joining BRICS. I think that actually might have been in the Globe Mail business section, even kind of raised that. Didn't really raise it as a I don't think it was an anti-Trump. I think it was 6 weeks, 2 months ago. I've seen a little bit of chatter in you know, left social media on that question. I think that that's a question that at least should be put forward by the left, or the radical left, if you want to call it that.
Well, has anybody at BRICS extended an invitation?
No, not as far as I know. I don't think that's obviously not a suggestion that has any applicable reality in, you know, in the here and now reality. That is more of a marker that some elements of the left should probably start raising as part of sort of counter geopolitical proposal to the ugly American. You know, there was an interesting statement, I think Jagmeet Singh's statement in response to Trump's incredible Gaza press conference with Netanyahu, where he went on a long rambling about taking over Gaza, expelling everyone and stuff like that. Jagmeet Singh's response, NDP leader's response later that night, pretty quickly, was very strong for Jagmeet Singh. He called it utter madness. He, you know, said Gaza is for Palestinians. For Singh was very strong. It got very wide circulation. To me, this was Jagmeet Singh is a bit boxed in on foreign policy issues because they have been so supportive of the U.S. empire on China, on the NATO proxy war, basically on military spending, on Iran. They don't have many issues that they can credibly go at Trump on. So, but Palestine over the past 14, 15 months, they've responded to the grassroots pressure and they've gotten a bit better on that issue. So hammering Trump on Gaza is one where he can both align with the Palestine solidarity world, but he can also align with the sort of anti-Trumpist kind of sentiment growing in Canadian politics more broadly. And you've seen some of the things that Charlie Angus has done on Gaza and stuff. Another politician who has been, I think, very aligned with the U.S. empire outlook. So there are little, you know, bits here and there of that. And I think that, you know, for us, people who you know, we didn't just learn about U.S. imperialism when, you know, Trump sort of said how he would turn it on Canada, where it's been a very obvious fact of one of the greatest horrors in the world. That for a long time, that you know, trying to use that moment where there's Canadians who seem to just be realizing that this devastating force exists out there, that we should, you know, be in solidarity with those under the boot of that U.S. imperialist force. There's problems with it, of course. Canadian nationalism has its problems. I don't think we should in any way mythologize on you know, Canadian foreign policy, let alone the dispossession and conquering of First Nations. But I think there's some political space there that should be worked with.
Yeah, well, certainly Gaza is only the latest of the greatest horrors that we've seen, I mean, in my entire lifetime, which has been longer than I'd like to admit sometimes. But what about things like, I mean, and it's easy for the NDP or for so-called leftists in this country to use Gaza as the cudgel against the Americans now that it's flat. Where were they a year and a half ago, you know, or 20 years ago or 30 years ago? But what about on simple things like we've been put into that corner, Canada has, and all the political parties that make up the parliament on relations with China, remembering the Meng Wanzhou and Huawei and that legal circus that Canada performed at the behest of the Americans, the same president who sits there now, and how much damage that did to our relations with China. Couldn't Mr. Singh or anybody in our government say, okay, we apologize, China. We apologize to all these people that we've insulted by going along with the American position all these years. Can we start anew and actually change course that way with some humility and contriteness?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any realistic policy possibility of an apology. I think there is a realistic possibility.
We're Canadians. Come on.
Well, if I were getting into the apologies, I would start on the foreign policy front. I'd start with apologies to Haiti over apologies to China. But on the China file, I think the problem for the NDP is they've not just been on board. They have been criticizing the Liberals for not being hawkish enough. And they even doubled down. The Vancouver MP, just totally blanking on her name, Vancouver East MP, Jenny Kwan. Yeah, she doubled down even when the Hogue Commission came out a report saying that basically there's nothing here with this whole foreign interference, which the whole foreign interference inquiry begins as an anti-China affair, and Jenny Kwan, in response to the commissioner coming out with basically saying there's not really anything here, she doubles down and says, you know, oh, this is proves the importance of how much we have to take seriously this foreign interference. And this, of course, at a time when the U.S. president is musing about annexing Canada by economic force, in his words.
You've just tuned in. You're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm talking today with Eve Engler. Eve is a Canadian journalist, author, and activist. He's written 13 books on and about the perfidy of Canada and its foreign policy. The latest, co-authored with Owen Schock, is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Recent among his many articles at eveengler.com is the one examining the antithetical of my introduction. Feed the war machine to appease Trump is ruling class solution. If that's the ruling class solution in Canada, what about in Canada taking this military cooperation, interoperability, whatever you want to call it, with the United States, and using that as a serious deterrence to further Trump meddling in our country, say canceling the F-35, say canceling some of these surface ships, say bringing Canadian forces that are deployed all over the world, assisting American imperial interests, bring them home on the excuse of training, or maybe we need them at the borders now that our borders are so porous and weak and in need of reinforcement. Is this a position anybody in this country, Eve, is taking up? Is this a position that could have any kind of legs?
Well, I think it could have legs. It should have legs. Rather than so far, what's happened is the opposite, where they've said, Trump has said, I'm thinking of annexing you, but I'm also concerned about how little you spend on the military. Those are actually quite paradoxical kind of positions to hold. If you're thinking of annexing a country, it's pretty rare that you want them to spend more on the military if you think their military is a threat to your power. But the U.S. doesn't consider the Canadian military a threat to its power, rightfully, because the U.S. military is actually, the Canadian military is actually an extension of the U.S. military. And so an obvious way to hit back at Trump would be to say, no, we're not going to spend more on U.S. arms if you're going to be threatening all these tariffs, or you're going to be threatening to take us over, or this and that. So you know, I've had people email me about this. I've seen some little mentions on this question of the F-35, but no, there isn't. You know, the NDP hasn't come out and said that, and they absolutely should be pressured to do that. But more broadly, beyond just the F-35, which is of course Lockheed Martin, it's a U.S. You know, there are Canadian contractors, but this would be, you know, I don't have the exact total, but this would be a big outflow of Canadian resources to the U.S. The Canadian contractors are getting, you know, ultimately going to get billions and billions of contracts, but it's only a small proportion of what Canada will spend, you know, to Lockheed Martin in the U.S. So yeah, that's something that should be put. But I think the whole relationship, the broader Canada military alliance, should be put into question, because the Canadian military has shown over and over again that it will prioritize its relationship to the U.S., its U.S. counterparts, than it will to the Canadian political leaders. You know, you look at 1962 and the embargo, the U.S. Blockade of Cuba, and the crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis of 62. The Halifax commander just sent a whole bunch of Canadian naval vessels to support that without any okay from the politicians who are against it. You look at the establishment of NORAD in the early 50s. It was ultimately established formally in 58. The Canadian Air Force begins a whole process of putting personnel down in Colorado, where the, you know, NORAD command, all, you know, is today, and does it all behind the backs of the political leaders. You look at the special forces, you know, and NORAD. If you look at how NORAD allows U.S. Commanders to dispatch Canadian fighter jets without an okay from Canadian political leaders. You look at Canadian special forces and how deeply tied in they are with U.S. Counterparts. Part of the reason we know anything about JTF-2, the elite special forces, is because the U.S. Special forces are more open about releasing information, so we learn about it through their operations. You look at, you know, when in Afghanistan early on in 2001, where Canadian JTF-2 were deployed with British and U.S., that only came about because of with their, you know, some photos from the U.S. Same thing in Iraq in 2006. JTF2 was involved in the rescue of a couple British Canadian hostages. And they never admitted it. It was because British and U.S. Special Forces told the CBC about it. So if you look at the Canadian military and the thinking, you look the, you know, right to the top echelon, the Canadian military, they've all been at U.S. trained colleges, the military colleges, all had really deep ties. In a sense, as one author put it, they've been vetted by the U.S. All the chiefs of defense staff for the past 20 some years have been essentially vetted by the U.S. Military. So that whole, the institution of the Canadian military is not structured to defend Canada from the U.S., which is the only country that could possibly invade Canada. It's structured to advance the U.S. war machine, and to a large extent, so is the, you know, the arms industry in this country is mostly branch plants of U.S. U.S. firms. So cutting contracts, reducing military spending, it cuts these contracts. So to me, if you're asserting sovereignty, if you were trying to say no, Donald Trump, what you would do is exactly what you present, hey, okay, we're canceling the F-35. We're gonna, we either ideally not purchase any new fighter jet, but at least maybe we'll look at the SWAB, the one that came in supposedly in second in the procurement process.
Where's the Avro Arrow? God damn it! I told you that was gonna happen.
Yeah, we might not want to go back all that way, but. The point being is that yes, that's, this should all be on the upside of the horribleness of Donald Trump is this sort of breaking down of the basic of this imperial relationship. And one element on that is that in some sense, one way to look at it is that the Joe Biden crowd are a little bit more sophisticated in operating the U.S. imperial machine. They know that by being so crass and so open that you are angering they would say unnecessarily elements of the Canadian ruling class or Canadian thinking and elsewhere in the world that elicits opposition and it elicits possibility for building sort of counter anti imperial. Jean Chrétien in his biography talks about how he told Bill Clinton if we can look a little independent, we can do things for you if we don't just look like the 51st state, we can do things for you that even the CIA can't do, right? So having a bit of independence can make Canada a more useful tool within the U.S. empire.
And he was a tool, was Chrétien, but he's preserved that aura about his premiership as being one, as a champion for Canadian independence of thought and action when we've talked about it. Now, there's no, it's pretty widely known that Canada was up to its knees, at least, in the Iraq war and in assisting the United States in that illegal war, just as they assist today the illegal actions America takes part in, and Israel, everywhere else around the world. Eve, we're fast running out of time. I don't want to let you go before giving you the chance to plug an upcoming webcast, which looks very interesting. Resisting the New McCarthyism in Canada is the title. It's put on through socialistaction.ca. Do you want to give us a minute or two about that on the way out?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically what we've seen over the past 16 months is a upsurge of anti-genocide protests in this country, probably the greatest example of internationalism, I think maybe in the history of Canada, opposition to Canada's role in supporting Israel's crimes in Gaza. But we've also seen this real reaction of authoritarianism. And you see it everywhere. You see it from the universities that are banning Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. You see it with municipalities that have banned protests in all kinds of areas. You see it with, you know, the arrests of the raiding of homes in Vancouver, the putting group like Sammy Noon on the terrorist list, a grassroots progressive organization on a terrorist list. You know, the Indigo 11 in Toronto. So you're seeing this real clampdown, and then you're just seeing it at the level of like the whole IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, definition of anti-Semitism, where you're just trying to basically institutionalize from, you know, different government departments to university departments to schools, an anti-Palestinian kind of ideology or a fear of challenging Zionism. And tomorrow's on Thursday nights, put on by Socialist Action, 8 p.m. Online webinar. People can find the registration on Socialist Action, Canada's Socialist Action's website. It's myself and someone from the BC Civil Liberties Association.
Aislinn Jackson. Yeah. Well, and also there's the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. You've got a YouTube page as well. I'm looking at it right now. You've got a lot of terrific stuff on what we've talked about and other stuff, what's going on. As you mentioned, there's in Haiti, but also in Congo, things that Canada has a long and inglorious record with. You can go to foreignpolicy.ca to link to a lot of Eve's other stuff, or eveangler.com. Eve, thanks a lot for coming on again. And as always, there's more topic than time. We'll have to catch up again the next time, eh?
Thanks for having me.
Stick around. Ross Crawford is coming up after the break with yet another mega project for Victoria City, another one that's absolutely necessary.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Victoria City Council has hatched another world-class scheme to divest you via tax rises of your nest egg and those of the next seven generations or so. Yes, it's another desperately needed mega project replete with vague cost estimates, dubious social uptake, and a returning cast of characters best known from past fiscal planning fiascos. This time, it's the aged Crystal Pool, a stone's throw from the erstwhile Memorial Arena, and in sight on tippy-tippy toes of the one-of-a-kind Johnson Street Bridge. Ross Crawford is an award-winning journalist, editor, author, civic activist, and co-founder of the Watchdog website, johnsonstreetbridge.org. He's too recipient of a Western Magazine Award for Business Writing, the Jack Webster Award of Distinction for Investigative Reporting, and he's a National Magazine Awardee for Sports Writing. Ross is also a regular contributor to Victoria's Focus Magazine, where his latest article, How Much Would It Cost to Fix Crystal Pool, rings a familiar tone. Welcome back to the program, Ross.
Hey, thank you.
Well, it's been way too long. If my records are right, it's been almost 5 years since we spoke last, Ross, and then about something other than the city's handling of infrastructure. For those Victorians, Ross, new to this issue, the majority of the population, I would say, judging by the meager turnout Saturday, can we begin with council's decision to put the question of what to do with the Crystal Pool to a citywide referendum?
The city needs to borrow a huge amount of money to build this pool. The projected cost is $209 million, it give or take, depending on exactly where they build it. So they need to borrow at least $170 million, which is something far beyond the capacity of the financial reserves that the city has. And so the requirement under provincial law is that you have to get voter approval to borrow such a huge amount of money. And there are two ways you can do it. One is by the notorious alternative approval process, which is a sort of negative option billing. And the city tried that with the Johnson Street Bridge way back when, which is that people, the citizenry is given a limited period of time to collect signatures on petitions opposing the borrowing. And if they get 10% of the eligible voters within 30 days or something like that, then the borrowing is stopped and the council has to decide what to do next. And in the case of the bridge, the petition drive was successful, and then the council decided to go with the referendum. In this case, the council just decided to go directly to referendum rather than trying this negative option billing approach. So, yeah, the referendum was necessary, but I think that the older I get, I have come to realize that many things that happen currently are reactions to things that have happened in the past, which is why progress is so slow, because we keep sort of redoing things or reacting to things that happened in the past. In any case, the reason why I say that is because the city generally, I'm talking not just about the municipal government,